live from the middle of nowhere. This is the Bob Davis Podcast, literally the middle of nowhere, Western Virginia near Buena Vista. There's a couple of small towns right near this farm where I am doing this podcast from. Buena Vista, Virginia is near 64 and 81. I think it's almost to the Blue Ridge Mountains. You'd have to check the map if you really wanted to. So this is Podcast 380, The New Talk, out here in the fading gloom of dusk in true rural America. So yeah, I'm in this beautiful place in Virginia, Western Virginia, and in a couple of days I'm going to be heading to Virginia Beach, Virginia, and then to Newport News, probably, because a relative of mine is flying helicopters in the Navy. That should be pretty cool, maybe. We'll see what happens with that. And then I'm going to drop into Washington, D.C., and then heading back to the Twin Cities. To do all this, of course, I need diesel fuel, and I really appreciate the donations you people have been giving me at thebobdavispodcast.com. If you want to donate to the Mobile Podcast Command and the Travel Log Road Trip Podcasts, it's great, and I don't care how much or how little you want to donate. It's great. It's always appreciated. It keeps me in Komodo Dragon coffee as well as diesel fuel, which is really important. All you have to do is click on the big yellow donate button underneath the picture of the Mobile Podcast Command unit, which is crowdfunded, and it'll take you to a window, and you can make your donation with a credit card of any that you want, and you're definitely appreciated, and I often thank people who have made donations either en masse in a single podcast or individually as we go. So if you've made donations, again, thanks for them at thebobdavispodcast.com with the big yellow donate button. And yeah, the podcast mobile command unit is something that my friend Ed at xgovernmentcars.com found for me. We had a long conversation about panel vans, and he said, get an ambulance. And so this thing really, Ed is kind of the father of the podcast mobile command unit. And I'm here to tell you that X Government Cars now has nicer, newer vehicles, Chargers, Impalas, next-gen Fords, plus trucks, vans, and SUVs. I've had three Crown Vics, and now, of course, the ambulance. But here's the thing about X Government Cars that's really, really important. They have great financing for all levels of credit, so it doesn't matter if it's good, bad, and ugly, everybody gets approved. And X Government Cars carries only one owner, professionally maintained government and fleet vehicles, as I have talked about for many, many years. In fact, since 2009, let's review. Cash deals direct from owner Ed Johnson, a three-day satisfaction guarantee, financing for all levels of credit. You can apply online safely and securely 24/7 at xgovernmentcars.com, or you can check them out and visit and talk 2420 Nevada Avenue North in Golden Valley, Minnesota. Don't forget the grand reopening event is on now, and everything is better at, dare I just pierce this beautiful, peaceful sound with the megaphone? I think so.
xgovernmentcars.com.
So yeah, true rural America. My sister lives out here on this really beautiful farm. This place is amazing. And she lives actually down the road from an old mill that was here during the Revolutionary War times. That's how old this place is. In fact, there was a town square there where they actually drilled Revolutionary War recruits. And there's really nothing left of the town or the mill. The mill was actually in better shape 25, 30 years ago. There were some efforts to restore it that failed. And now pretty much the mill is just falling into a pond and a sort of dam there. The neighbors had a house before they moved. There was a house over there that was built, as near as they could tell, going back to the 1700s. So this little area where I am goes back more than 200 years. And I think the thing that's interesting, I mean, going back to before the Revolutionary War, and I think the thing that's interesting about all this is to understand that the mill formed the center of agriculture around here. And all around here are these small farms, really almost like Europe, where the farms just aren't as big as they are in the United States, although there's obviously been some consolidation over the years. But it's really cool because the thing I think about when I think about those times is they didn't think that they were old times. I mean, to them, they were doing something that was really cutting edge, and I'm sure that that town at the time, new technology was the mill. I mean, the farmers could bring their corn and other grains right to the mill, and they would be ground up and bagged, and then they could take them to market. So that was pretty, you know, that was pretty downtown back in the day. And when you're here, you spend a fair amount of time thinking about how much things have changed and how none of those people could have predicted what things would be like 200 years later. And so what I'm talking about when I talk about the United States, it's really, it's important in it. And I challenge myself to think not where we're going to be in 20 to 50 years, although it's very important, I think, to think about that 10 years, 20 years, 50 years. But really 200 plus years, where does what we have now take us to? And I think if we could live that long to actually see the kinds of changes, we'd have a little bit different view of what it is that we think we're doing these days. I wonder what our reaction would be to those kinds of changes. And then there are also other kinds of issues that come with rural life. If you want to go to the doctor's office, which my sister goes to the doctor an awful lot, it's a 70-mile trip to the good doctors, and my sister has to make this trip every now and then. She just got surgery for something, and she's back and forth all the time. And then the other kinds of issues, the connectivity issues, and I have to admit, I sound like a snob, but slow internet drives me crazy. She has DirecTV, and I don't know whether it's the satellite, I don't know whether it's the modem, I don't know, we've looked at everything, or whether it's just a decision to just get slow internet. I realize that aside from the slow internet, when you're watching television the old way, and I don't watch television the old way, I talk about this all the time. Everything I do is on demand. I cut the cord a long time ago, and it's all on the computer or through Apple TV, and it's all broadband. I don't watch regular TV. So it's been since the last time I was down here, really, in Thanksgiving, where I actually sat and watched regular television, and it's sickening. It's just, you're watching what is pushed toward you, and, you know, it's horrible. I mean, and then it's all the commercials. No wonder people are depressed all the time. You end up watching these commercials where people are either taking all these drugs, and I'm amazed, and I guess, you know, everybody who watches television knows this, but I'm amazed at the side effects from all these drugs. And then you see an indigestion commercial juxtaposition by a pizza commercial. And you think to yourself, well, no wonder you're taking the indigestion drug, or no wonder you're taking the diabetes drug. You just saw a commercial where chocolate is pouring into a bowl, or they're selling a pizza, none of which anyone needs. You know, you're exhorted to want to buy that by watching these TV ads. Now, in podcast time, it's Tuesday night, and usually I try to get a podcast up for Wednesday, but this internet situation is such that I might not even be able to post this until I drive into town tomorrow, or at least up to the local diner and see if I can use the internet up there to post the podcast. I'll certainly try. But just take a moment and listen to this place. Now, it may have hit 90 in the Twin Cities today. And by the way, there's been a little bit of a discussion on Twitter, which I haven't been able to get to because I'm completely out of the loop right now on my predictions regarding the global warming summer, which I was talking about in the last podcast. And I've said, I think it's going to be a hot summer in the upper Midwest. And, you know, if you're not from the upper Midwest, you don't know that it's unusual to have 90-degree temperatures in June in anywhere in North or South Dakota or Minnesota in June. Now, it certainly happens. It usually doesn't happen until July. But, and I think the last time, this is the warmest it has been since July of 2013. So I think it's going to be a really hot summer in the Twin Cities. And I am sticking by my predictions, even though some people have pilloried me for that and made fun of me. Well, they haven't really pilloried me, but they've made fun of me for saying it's going to be a global warming summer. But it has been 90 here for quite a while. June in Virginia, it starts to get hot. The cool thing about Virginia is it gets hot and it stays hot for a long time. So we're now into that super heat of Virginia, and I love it. You can't get it hot enough for me. And tonight, as the dusk gloom fades into night, I just realized that the doors are open on the ambulance, and you know, I got the lights on in the ambulance, and I didn't think there were any bugs out here because last night it rained and there weren't any bugs. And yes, the mobile podcast command unit is full of bugs. So I just spent a fair amount of time with hair dryer. We don't have any bug spray. So I've spent a fair amount of time with a hair dryer and some sort of cleaning stuff. in an effort to sort of blow these things out of here and then close the doors and keep them out. So this is going to be crazy. And I've been actually sleeping in this here, and I don't even know if I want to sleep in here tonight because of the situation with the bugs. Anyway, so the bug story is bothering me, and that's going on. And also the very slow internet has been bothering me. And as I said, we've been watching a lot of reality television, Amazing Decks, Hell's Kitchen, old movies. And we've been arguing, as only the Davis family can argue. So here it is almost midnight, and I'm exhausted, and now I have these bugs in the ambulance to deal with. So this is going to be very, very interesting tonight. Anyway, I'm still not seeing, even with my slow internet, any salient developments in the news. There are some things to talk about, and I don't want to just sit here and talk about bugs, although that's kind of cool. But I ended up pulling probably 15 or 20 stories, and I get it winnowed down to three or four things that I end up having passion for. And I don't want to say it's not the usual political stuff, but the way I do what I do, I don't pay any attention to what these people are saying. I'm reading what is being written generally. And so what happens is the dots get connected sooner for me than perhaps the things that people are trying to bring to people on cable television and talk radio. So what I'm seeing is in many ways not the usual political stuff, which is very personality driven right now. Who said what about who? And I don't think that that solves anything, and I don't think that it informs anyone. What ends up happening is you end up hearing and seeing the same themes introduced and reintroduced again and again and again on all these different fronts. And I don't want to be seen as someone who says, you know, you should tune it out, but we have to have some level of strategy about how we get information. And that is really the overarching mission of these podcasts, especially in an election year. If I'm not doing the travelogue stuff, or if I'm not doing something that's really way off the beaten path, to connect this stuff for you a little bit, because most people just don't, they aren't going to do what I do because it's not their job. And what I've arrived at is this way of trying to really see and feel what is salient. And the way that I do it is I really just do with what I'm passionate about. And so I'm reading as much as I can about what's going on and trying to put it in some kind of order for you. And in doing this, my editorial bias comes into play, and I don't think that's a problem because generally I try to make my biases as clear as I can. I was talking to somebody the other day, and they were talking about talk radio and the history of talk radio as being, you know, people are afraid to be involved with it or to advertise or to be part of it. And I said, you know, one of the things I've been doing is really getting away from that because I'm not trying to get you upset so that you'll call in. What I'm trying to do is get you to think about what you think is important, because that's really what people in this country have to start doing, is thinking about what's important to them and why. And commentators and pundits and whatever we are, whatever I am, our job is really to say, hey, think about this, or what do you think about this, or what kinds of question would come up on this so that you can talk about it. And increasingly, it doesn't have a political pull. It's one of the most difficult things that I have to deal with whenever I go out and talk to people, either on the left or the right, is that there's an initiating sort of siloing where people try to figure out what side of the fence that you're on and whether or not they're going to talk to you and whether or not you're going to be able to get through the lattice work of their political orientation. But increasingly, the issues don't make any sense, and they don't make any sense in political orientation. So I'm going to talk about that a little bit, but I want to look at a couple of three different things and talk about those three different things that today came up for me. And the first one is on the economy. There's a lot being written about the economy in the present time frame, and it just is being spit out. You know, if you look at the financial blogs, obviously these guys are writing to each other. They're writing to traders, they're writing to analysts, they're writing to bankers. So everybody's having these arguments about the central bank, or they're having these arguments about the economy, or they're writing, you know, to economists. And so they're not really writing for the general public, but there's a lot filtering out onto television and into the mainstream media on the economy. And you say, well, why is that important? Why is it important to talk about the economy first, especially on a day when this or that happened and this one said this about that, or that one said this about her, you know, or him? And the reason is because depending on what the statistics are, which department issued them, or whether it's the Labor Department or the Federal Reserve or the National Bureau of Economic Research, the Fed, all federal agencies or public-private partnerships with a vested interest in the federal government, basically bureaucrats who incidentally work for the president or incidentally have a vested interest in the status quo. Even the Congressional Budget Office, which is notoriously biased and usually wrong, even with the so-called reforms that they've made recently, our elected representatives will end up making law based on these statistics. So they're important, and the conclusions on the statistics are important. And yet, the average person is awash in theory and statements about what happened when the editors and the writers really don't know if what happened is what actually happened or if what happened leads to this, that, or the other thing. Now, up until the first quarter of this year, the storyline was that the U.S. economy was roaring back. You heard me talk about it more than once. And the cheaper gasoline was going to act like a tax cut and stimulate the consumer. And I was just shocked at the number of people who just repeated that over and over and over again. And we're starting to see the first spate of stories that are saying why that is not happening. Now, when it did not happen, you started to see the excuses flow. And why excuses? Well, because the rosy scenario that we have seen in the for the past 6 to 8 years must be caveated and explained and then restarted every quarter when the economy either grows very little bit or doesn't grow. And now the reason the economy isn't growing is the winter and the strong dollar and the cheap gas are all causing problems and the big slowdown in the first quarter. But we don't really know whether we had a slowdown in the first quarter yet. We also don't know what really caused it yet. But there's no shortage of people to tell you what is actually happening. And one of my favorite is, don't worry, because things are going to come back in the second, third, and fourth quarters. You know, they all say this, but they're basing it on employment, or they're basing it, and I call them Pollyannas, meaning they're whistling past the graveyard because they don't really know whether the economy is going to come roaring back in the second, third, and fourth quarters or not. It would have to be huge growth in order to make up for the really slow growth in the fourth and the first quarter that supposedly was caused by winter and the strong dollar. The fact is, this has been the trend that we have seen since this president enacted policies to quote-unquote fix the economy, because the previous administration had driven the economy into a ditch. And so things had to be done, and they were done. And we have seen shallow increases in GDP and then decreases back to or below zero throughout the so-called recovery. And this is what is weighing on the jobs. This is why there are 92 or 93 million people out of the workforce. This is why part-time jobs are being created. And based on what I'm reading, I have come to the conclusion that we have reached the point where no one really knows what is happening or going to happen with the quote-unquote economy. Most of the supply-side guys have retired. And really, there's a sort of weird mixture of Keynesian and classic economics, and even people arguing. I saw a piece this week where somebody actually argued, well, Keynes was actually a supply-sider. And that kind of stuff is very confusing to people, and it's also very scary. And what it allows, and this is why it's important, it allows politicians to make all kinds of claims about what needs to be done because there's no overarching economic philosophy. You can talk, you can be Paul Ryan or Rubio or Bush, and you can talk about tax cuts for the middle class. You can be Rand Paul and talk about how we have to help poor people and all this stuff out of none of them. And this is why I keep talking about that. Am I hearing an economic policy, so to speak? I suppose, you know, well, I'm not going to say. I just think what people need to do is listen for some semblance of a cogent economic policy that's going to produce robust growth for the United States. And here's an example. There's a big debate right now about whether the strong dollar hurts or helps the economy. One of the reasons that they've offered for the economy slowing down is that the weak dollar was helping manufacturing and it was helping the energy sector. And now that the dollar is strengthening, it's hurting that sector and we need to weaken the dollar. And there's a whole group of people that are saying, no, the strong dollar in the long term will actually help the economy. Larry Kudlow is one of them. That's a great argument that people should be aware of, because we're not hearing the strong dollar argument in the mainstream media. All we're hearing is, well, if we had a stronger dollar, we wouldn't be having these problems. When in fact, a weak dollar, in other words, if you suppress the currency on purpose and make the dollar weaker on purpose to help exports, really what you're doing is you're subsidizing the export industry. And in this case, it's the oil industry that's getting a huge subsidy by a weaker dollar. That's a little bit of that argument. So what's the takeaway? Well, I think it comes down to individuals asking themselves questions. Do you think the U.S. has an economic problem? Do you think it's inequality? Do you think it's too much free trade or too little? Do you think it is too many years of slow or no growth and too much economic and social and business intervention and regulation by the federal government in particular, but also by state and local governments as well? And I would say pick your poison and ask yourself what needs to be done. I would love to see people actually having that conversation, even if it's just with yourself, to try to figure out what's going on. And I think too often people point to a candidate, they silo. In other words, they live inside this latticework of a certain political philosophy, and that's where they're comfortable. And they listen to candidates that fit that latticework, and that's where they stand. And I think we need to get out of that. I can certainly sit here and advocate for what I believe, but I want you to think about it. That's my passion, is that people actually start thinking about this themselves and come up with some answers on your own. There are too many people in media telling us what we should think, and that's a big part of our problem. And then 10 years later or 5 years later, you hear them say, well, that was wrong. And we wonder why we get into these situations that we get into. We as citizens aren't thinking enough about this stuff. And I don't even know, some people probably don't even know how to begin to think about this stuff. And it's one of the reasons I'm doing these podcasts. Another story that jumps out at me is this Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, because I know that there are people who are on all different ends of the political spectrum who aren't free traders. They believe that free trade takes American jobs away. I've always been a free trader, and the reason for it is you like rice, and somebody else likes something that you make, and comparative advantage is a good thing. But this situation that we have now is this Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, and every Republican should pay close attention to what their congressman, if they're Republican, does. Why do I say this? Because the Republicans are pushing this for the president, and the Democrats are against it. Moderates like Paul Ryan and Speaker Boehner and Mitch McConnell are all about passing this authority for the president, while none of the citizens in this country have been able to read it, and no one has been able to report on it with any degree of authority because we can't read it. You have to depend on WikiLeaks to find out what is in this bill, and what I've read about what is in it, even though it's one or two articles, of the actual agreement, is disturbing to me. Things like controlling media, things like controlling formation of business and capital and banking and things like that as part of a trade agreement really bothers me. And because this agreement has been negotiated in private and is being kept in a vault in the basement of the Capitol building, where if you're a congressman or a senator, you have to go to read it, I don't think, given this president's performance in office as regards executive authority, predicates any reason to give him any more authority. I think it's very dangerous to do that, not because I hate Obama, but because of his track record on this kind of thing. He just told the NSA this week, don't worry what Congress does with the Patriot Act, just keep doing what you're doing. I don't think that's right, and I think that's a real problem. He also said today, well, I'm going to tell you what I think about this case that the Supreme Court is taking before they rule. And he's done this before, where he wants to get the upper hand so that he can poo-poo the court because he thinks he's this incredible constitutional scholar. Many Democrats are against this bill, and I have been listening to some of the reasons, and generally it's they're trade protectionists, which I think is a mistake. But here we have an opportunity to have true bipartisan cooperation because some of the, I don't know whether you call them conservatives or what, Duncan Hunter, for example, are pressuring House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy to push to vote no or table this bill. Don't you find it interesting, if you sit on a certain part of the political landscape these days, that the more these guys pay lip service to the so-called conservative values, the more they seem to ignore them when the wallets come out at the chambers of Italian fascism? And yes, there was a time when the mainstream Republican was for free trade, and I, again, am a free trader, but I am not for giving this president any more authority on anything, let alone something like this, if I can't read it. I want to read this bill, and I want reporters to be able to report on it, and I want to ask congressmen a question without having them say, well, you'd have to read the bill. Yeah, but I can't, congressman, even though I'm expected to allow you to grant this president really extraordinary authorities. It's just not right to me. And this is the kind of issue, frankly, that should be tabled until the American people have a chance to cast their votes in 2016. And I personally think Republicans don't have to explain anything. All they have to do is say this is something that needs to be revisited after the election because they just don't trust this president. And the American people haven't had a chance to actually read the bill, whether they're Democrats or Republicans. It's a service to all of us, regardless of our political spectrum, to say, you know what, maybe we just better wait on this. And by the way, as an aside, I've often said one of the final stages in socialism leading to fascism is that the government can't do what it's supposed to do very well, but it becomes very efficient at doing things it isn't supposed to do. Now, our government was constituted to protect our rights. It wasn't constituted to make sure that there's no cyclamates in high C. It wasn't constituted necessarily to do things that progressives have, both Republican and Democrat, have pushed to have us do. It wasn't constituted to outlaw the use of this or that. It wasn't constituted to put in a certain kind of highway or sidewalk in your neighborhood, and it wasn't constituted to spy on the people or oppress the people. It was constituted to protect our rights. Apparently, China has been hacking into the U.S. government databases and collecting data on U.S. officials, very high officials, with the intention of controlling them. Now, what's interesting about the story is we haven't been told which officials they have data on. We're talking about the results of FBI background checks, financial data, and other kinds of incriminating data. And isn't it interesting? We don't know which officials and which candidates they have this information on. And yet, apparently, our federal government computers are wide open to these hackers. So the federal government can ignore the new rules regarding spying on Americans, but they can't protect our data from the Russians and the Chinese. And this is exactly what I'm talking about. You have an executive branch really kind of running amok right now, and I guess that's an understatement for some people and an overstatement for others, but I'm not sure that I like, and I'll say this to the people on the left end of the spectrum, you know, you may be all for Barack Obama overstepping his bounds as president, but you're not going to like it very much when Jeb Bush does it. And this is exactly, again, what I'm talking about. We have a sclerotic, poorly managed agency throughout the government, agencies all over the government, that can't do what they're supposed to do, like the IRS. But they can be used to suppress the kinds of political activity somebody doesn't like. We have the Secret Service, which is supposed to be protecting the president, but is hanging out with, you know, whores down in Colombia, as well as the DEA having orgies. They're supposed to be protecting our rights, but in fact, they're running amok. My view is, the so-called conservative view, and I don't know whether it's Republican or Democrat anymore, is simple. Nothing moves until these problems get solved. Now, you can scream and yell and pound and go on TV and drum up support for not shutting down the government all you want, but I am starting to think that shutting down the government, especially the federal government, might be the best thing that we could possibly do, especially when it's running around doing things it shouldn't be doing. And I'm not so sure people on both ends of the political spectrum wouldn't support it. Another theme that comes up every election year is back, and that is, why isn't there any strong independent parties? Gerald Sieb in the Wall Street Journal, or Sieb, I don't know how you spell his name, or say his name from the spelling, I always get it wrong. He believes a third party is strained to break out. I disagree with him, and I'll tell you why in a second. And of course, his solution is that we need to allow more independent politicians in the debates. This is bad analysis. First of all, I don't think that there are too many independent voters. I think there's a lot of fence sitters who end up waiting until the last minute because they get a lot of attention when they tell pollsters that they haven't decided yet. They also get a lot of attention at parties because they don't have to say, I am for donuts, or I am for bacon, or I am for vegetables. They can say, well, I can see the arguments for vegetables and donuts, you know, and who doesn't like some bacon once in a while? They don't want to stand there and say, well, I'm a Republican or I'm a Democrat. It's going to give credence to the argument that, quote, someone could have won if he or she had been in the debates. That's what this kind of bad analysis does. And then it gives way to these conspiracy theories. If this person had won, the country would have been different. And he didn't because they wouldn't let him on Fox News, or they wouldn't let him in the debates, or for whatever reason. And we're heading into the same situation. They're reintroducing this independent theme again. And it's great for the media, because the media can say, what do the independents think? So I think there are people who are truly independent, but it's a very small percentage. Now, I've said for a long time that all this politicking for president, especially on the Republican side, isn't good. I've also said that all this politicking in a particular state is a bad thing, not because I have a problem with that state, but I am beginning to think debates, especially in primary races and caucuses in various states, is a very bad thing. First, and I'll say it for both, you know, parties. These are caucuses and primaries, and so these candidates are really preaching to the choir. They're looking for delegates to back them up, especially after the primaries. Primary elections are all about the actives, and the turnout is notoriously low, even in presidential cycles. So this is the politically involved, and so they're out there pushing to really, it's retail politics to get the 20% or 30% that are going to vote in the primary or the caucuses to go out and work for them as a candidate. Having a debate to make everybody look stupid doesn't really further that at all. And adding independents to those debates, and I don't know how you can allow a fourth-rate Republican or Democrat candidate and not allow an independent or libertarian or socialist or even communist candidate, isn't going to help any independent parties. You know, for years, Gus Hall in Chicago, who is a communist, ran for every office, and he never won. But he was in all the debates, and it was kind of entertaining. U.S. elections, even national elections, are state-by-state elections. There is no such thing as a national election in the United States. There are 50 state elections and territorial elections. Political parties control the process in the 50 states by constitutional predicate. The states decide who votes, how they vote, when they vote, and political parties make the rules in the individual states with the state legislatures. This is also true in the territories. Independents traditionally just don't poll enough votes to even be considered. But sometimes that changes, and I'm reminded of a couple of independent candidates. Obviously, Teddy Roosevelt ran as a Bull Moose candidate. He lost. But what the independent party needs is a candidate and an issue, one candidate and one issue, to win a nationwide election. And I think it's possible, because what you have to do is overwhelm one of the mainline party's organizations in 50 states and several territories. Now, one of the other elections, and I'm not sure, I didn't quite read up on this, but my impression of what happened in 1860 is Abe Lincoln was the candidate for a brand new party, the Republican Party, that was an anti-slavery party. And the pro-slavery side of the Whig Party broke and went with the Democrats, and the anti-slavery side of the Whig Party broke and went with the new Republicans. And what happened was the Whig Party basically threw in the towel in the different states and became Republicans or Democrats based on the slavery issue, which, by the way, set the stage for the Civil War and secession and then the Civil War. Lincoln won and the Whig Party was no more. So that's a perfect example of a single candidate overwhelming state party organizations because of one issue. Why don't we have multiple parties in this country? Well, we actually do have multiple parties in the United States. You just never see them because they're not big enough or widely appealing enough. And organizations like the Tea Party are not political parties in waiting. And I would simply point, if you're in the Tea Party, this is an interesting question, because if the Tea Party did reorganize as a political party, you'd have to change your tax classification. It would actually be interesting, because you might have enough votes to challenge some of these state party leaders and take over the party organizations or dissolve them, especially if the Tea Party was able to caucus with libertarians and independence party people. The question is whether or not that could happen. And this is what happens with factions. The founders never visualized political parties. They thought that factions would form, coalitions and factions would form around issues in the state and the federal legislatures. They weren't prepared for actual parties to form. But having said that, if you go back 260 years to the Anti-Federalists, or 200 whatever it is, 40 years to the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, even before the Revolutionary War, you will see that these parties literally have shifted poles and changed over the years. So there is fluidity in the American political process. It's just in the present time frame, the last 50, 60 years, the Democrats and the Republicans have pretty much been stable. But that doesn't mean that they will always be stable. And this is certainly true in states with weak Republican or Democratic party structures. I'm thinking about Minnesota and California, both of whom have weak Republican state party structures. So I'll leave some of you people with that. If you're, you know, you're going to hear this theme come up again and again. Oh, we need an independent party. Well, I'm not so sure that that's what's necessary. I think what's necessary is that if we're going to, if you're going to have an independent political party, you've got to overwhelm one of the other two parties. And I've thought for a long time that the Democratic Party was going to dissolve. But I'm starting to believe that the number of candidates this time with the Republican Party indicates to me a very weak and diffused and confused Republican Party. I still don't see a philosophy emerging from all this, and I don't think the debates are going to winnow any philosophy down to one or two candidates that have a philosophy and an idea that's going to be something that people are going to say, yeah, I want to vote for that. I don't think all this politicking and candidacies are good for the Republicans at all. And if you start to see more and more Democratic candidates doing this, I don't think that's good either. I think some Democrats really would like to see a parliamentary system, but we don't have a parliamentary system in the United States. We have a republic, so it's a little bit different structure. And I would advise people to read as much as they can about what a republic is versus a parliamentary democracy, because there's a key difference, and it's very hard to cobble onto a republic something that's more unstable in an interest of getting more independent political parties involved with the process. The target should be one of the mainline parties, because if you can control the apparatus of a mainline party, then you've really got something if you're an independent looking for a voice. So I will leave you with that and the bugs. Thanks to xgovernmentcars.com for sponsoring podcast 380. Don't forget, they got Chargers, Impalas, next-gen Fords, which includes eventually the Ford SUV and the Ford Police sedan, plus trucks, vans, and SUVs, Expeditions, Yukons, all kinds of stuff like that. Great financing for all levels of credit. Everybody gets approved, and you can apply safely and securely right now at xgovernmentcars.com. And thanks, Ed, for sponsoring podcast 380, the Bob Davis podcast. Yeah, I still got the megaphone right here.
xgovernmentcars.com.
Let's talk digital sponsors of the Bob Davis podcast, Mad K Studios, creating quality original automotive artwork. Mad K is going to be at some of these antique auto shows this summer. If you click on that banner, it takes you to their Facebook page. You'll see where they're going to be. They do really great original automotive artwork. So if you have a favorite car or a work truck or something, you're not just going to get a picture of it. You're going to get a piece of art, and it's really cool. And I'll tell you more about where they're going to be as we get closer to some of these events. Click on their banner as well as all the banners of the Bob Davis podcast sponsors for more information about all these guys. And again, thank you guys for listening at Stitcher.com, iTunes, or TuneIn. These are just services that distribute and syndicate the podcasts internationally. Also, blogtalkradio.com and TuneIn both have players on the page at thebobdavispodcast.com. And then again, you can also listen to the podcasts right on the page at thebobdavispodcast.com. Underneath each podcast, liner note is a little player. Click on that and you can listen right on the page and you're good to go. And thank you for subscribing and liking and sharing and favoriting and following on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. And thanks for your donations at thebobdavispodcast.com.